Today's lecture is lecture one in chapter 16, and I call it The Long and Winding Road, DNA is Discovered to be the Molecule of Heredity. And so I'm going to tell you about three very famous experiments to determine what the genetic material was. If we go back to the early part of the 20th century, it was Thomas Hunt Morgan, who was the fly guy at Columbia. And he's the one that showed us that genes are on chromosomes, and chromosomes were found in the nucleus of cells. Okay? Really important stuff. And at that time, if you go back in the history of science, you realize that there were two main chemicals that were the candidates for being the genetic material. And these two candidates were proteins and deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. Okay, so the thing about deoxyribonucleic acid, it was called a nucleic acid because it was first discovered in the nucleus, hence nucleic, and it was acidic in nature, and hence the word acid. And DNA was really first discovered in the 1800s. Some guy who was doing work discovered it, and he realized it was this chemical in the nucleus, had no idea what its function was or anything. You know, just knew a little bit about it. Okay? Now, it wasn't a trivial question as to which chemical carried the genetic material, because if you want to think about it, the people who were wondering, you know, what could it be, and the two main candidates were protein or DNA, although you couldn't completely preclude the others. But at the time, people throughout the 20th century, if you were a betting person and you were going to put your money on one of these molecules, it'd probably be protein. And the reason why is because protein is much more complicated than DNA. There's 20 different amino acids in proteins, and they can be mixed up in different ways. And since, you know, you think, well, the hereditary material must be pretty complicated because, you know, look what it's got to do. And if you look at DNA, there are only four nitrogenous bases, you know, A, T, C, and G, and you're like, well, that's not as complicated. So the thought was that proteins, the betting people would have bet on proteins. So it wasn't trivial, and it took a number of different experiments over a number of decades to really sort it all out. So we'll begin in the 1920s with an English physician by the name of Frederick Griffith. And he made a serendipitous discovery. And what he was trying to do is, let's kind of like do a little time machine, you know, take ourselves back to the early part of the 20th century. Pretty interesting back then. In the 1920s, there were no antibiotics. So if you got an infection, you there was a high probability you would die, because there was no way to really fight it. So, and I mean, today as we kind of think of, something, a bacterial infection is kind of trivial. You go down to the, doctor, he gives you a prescription for some antibiotic, you take a week or 10 days of antibiotics, the infection's gone. I mean, it's not true of all infections, because now we're sort of in a biological arms or chemical biological arms race with bacteria, because the bacteria are out-evolving our chemical defenses, our antibiotics. And so the pharmaceutical companies are spending billions of dollars a year on trying to sort of outsmart bacteria so that they can, develop the latest antibiotic to defeat these little prokaryotes that are evolving, a way to get around the antibiotics. But nonetheless, we're glad to have antibiotics, but in the 1920s, they didn't. And it's interesting, if you look at like what people died of in the early 20th century, it was infectious diseases. That's what killed most people. And today, we don't worry that much about infectious diseases. The big killer, the big three are heart disease, stroke, and cancer. Those are the big three. So antibiotics have made a huge difference in our lives. But back in the 1920s, they didn't have antibiotics, so Griffith was trying to develop a vaccine against a bacteria. Now, the bacteria was Streptococcus pneumoniae, Let's make sure we can all pronounce that. Streptococcus pneumoniae, repeat. Good. And this is the bacteria that causes, you know, pneumonia in humans. So pretty deadly, you know, little prokaryote. And what he was working with two different strains. So you can have, you know, genus and species, Streptococcus pneumoniae. That particular organism can have different strains. And there was a S strain and an R strain. The S strain produced what are called smooth-looking colonies. And what we mean by this is if you grow the bacteria on a petri dish, you get a whole you get little colonies. And if you look at the colonies just with the naked eye, they look really smooth. Hence, that's why they named them smooth, and that's why they call them the S strain. We came to find out that these bacteria had a special polysaccharide coat, and that's what made them look smooth when they're in a colony. Now let's do a quick review of prokaryotes. They have a cell membrane, just like all cells do, lipid bilayer, right? But what do all bacteria have outside of the cell membrane? Anyone remember? Yeah. Not a capsule. They don't all have capsules. But they do all have something. Does anyone remember? This is from the first week of school. Sam. That's right. They have a cell wall. All bacteria have a cell wall. It's not made out of cellulose. Very good. There are organisms that have a cell wall that are made out of cellulose. What are those organisms called? Plants, right. The prokaryotes have a cell wall that's made out of different material. Now, this polysaccharide coat is actually outside of the cell wall. So just kind of letting you know. Now, there is an R strain, which produce what are called rough-looking colonies. So these are colonies, you'd see them on the petri dish, but they wouldn't look smooth. They kind of look a little rough. And the reason they are rough is because they didn't have this special protective coat, this special protective polysaccharide coat, and hence they were rough. Okay, so the S strain, he took the S strain and he injected them into mice, and he found that within a day, the mice were dead. So he said, well, this S strain is virulent. And the word virulent means disease-causing. Pretty nasty. Well, let's all say the word virulent. Virulent, yeah. Okay. Now, it turns out that the virulence was found to be due to the fact that the bacteria had this polysaccharide coat, which actually protects them from the immune defense of the host, in this case, the mice. So I want you to think about this. We all have an immune system. And the immune system is like our homeland security. It's always looking for foreigners. And so if there's anything foreign, it will attack, you know, something foreign that is maybe bad for us. Okay? Well, it turns out that if a bacteria puts a polysaccharide coat around it, it's like under the radar, it can't be seen or it can't be detected by the immune system, and therefore, that's why it was able to kill the mice. Now, the R strain, when that strain was injected into the mice, it didn't cause disease, and so we say that the R strain was non-virulent. Now, why? Well, it turns out that because they don't have the protective polysaccharide coat, they are the immune system can pick up on these bacteria and immediately attack them and kill them. So basically, you know, the immune system takes care of the R strain. So what Griffith did is he did something interesting. He said, okay, he heat killed the virulent S strain of bacteria, and then he injected them into mice. And when he did, the mice lived, which makes sense. I mean, this is why when you, you're in a third world country, you have to be careful about the water, so what do? You boil the water. If you boil the water, you kill all the bacteria, so you're fine. Maybe if you're backpacking and you're worried about the water, you boil the water. No problem. You've killed the bacteria. So this makes sense. But then he did something rather interesting because, you know, he's trying to figure out how to come up with a vaccine, so he's trying all these different experiments. So he took some of the heat-killed S strain, which is virulent, and he mixed them with the non-virulent R strain that was living. So he basically had a dead virulent strain that had been, heat killed, mixed it with a live R strain. And what he found out was, to his astonishment, the mice died of pneumonia. So something weird was going on here that he didn't expect. And what happened? Well, it turns out that some of the non-virulent R strain of bacteria had been transformed. That's the important word, had been transformed into a virulent S strain. And so this word transformed, transformation, as we say in the next slide, it turns out that Griffith realized that a chemical from one cell was capable of genetically transforming another cell. Never been seen before in the history of biology. And so I'm going to fast forward 100 years, and I'm going to give you the official definition of transformation from our perspective. We now define it as a change in genotype and therefore phenotype due to the assimilation of external DNA by a cell. That's what transformation is. You guys have all done an experiment. You guys remember the transformation experiment you did either freshman year or some of you sophomore year? What was it? Can someone explain it to me? Yeah. Yeah, what happened? Right. And so what you essentially did, this is interesting, you took bacteria that didn't have a jellyfish gene, but what you did is you simply put the jellyfish gene in the medium outside of the bacteria, and then the bacteria, you did some fancy stuff in the lab to allow the bacteria to absorb that jellyfish gene into its cell, and then it basically incorporated it into its own DNA. That's transformation. Just bringing DNA from the outside, it can be from anything, through the cell wall into your own cell and incorporating it. That's what transformation is. So what's interesting is Griffith discovered transformation, but he didn't know the substance that was doing the transforming. He didn't know that it was DNA. And it took 30 more years before they ever really discovered the chemical nature of what we call this transforming agent. So let's go to the next slide and see how they did that. So this is the second experiment. By the way, your homework assignment tonight is going to be to do three responses. So it looks like a lot of work, but it's really not. Because I could have made it one free response, but I thought it would be just more logical to make it three. Basically, what you're going to do is you're going to reproduce each of the three experiments I'm talking about in this lecture. So I've just finished experiment one. Now I'm going to go on to experiment two. So this experiment was done in 1944, and it was published by Avery, McLeod, and McCarty. And the good news about these three scientists is that their experiment established DNA as the transforming principle, the transforming agent. It was DNA. That was the good news. Now here's the bad news. Many scientists didn't believe them. So here you go. You've established this revolutionary idea, but a lot of people don't believe you. And the reason people didn't believe them is because of what I told you a little bit earlier in the lecture, that the bias in the scientific community was that proteins were the genetic material. So nobody would, people had trouble buying into this idea that it could have been DNA, even though they published this in a very reputable science journal. So here's what they did. Their basic experiment was very simple. They repeated Griffith's experiment, but what they did is they took the transforming agent and they realized it's got to be one of four kinds of biochemical molecules. It's going to be either proteins, nucleic acids, carbohydrates, or lipids. Remember, we learned about those earlier in the course when we talked about the biochemistry unit. We said there's four major groups of macromolecules, and these are the four. So what they did is they said, okay, what we'll do is we'll use enzymes that are specifically destroy these different macromolecules and will use those enzymes to help us do the experiment. So what they did is they said, okay, we'll take the transforming agent and we're going to use a enzyme that destroys proteins, nucleic acids, and carbohydrates. You know, they would use, they're different enzymes, but they destroyed the proteins and nucleic acids and carbohydrates, and then they saw, they knew that all they had was lipids left, and they found that, oh, it doesn't transform the organism, so the transforming agent can't be lipids. And they said, okay, well, let's do another experiment. We'll destroy the proteins. We'll just use enzymes that destroy proteins, and then other ones that destroy nucleic acids, and then other ones that destroy lipids, and we'll see, you know, if carbohydrates are the transforming agent. And no, it wasn't. And they, you know, did this again, and they destroyed the nucleic acid, the carbohydrates, the lipids, and they found out that proteins didn't transform it. So finally, they did the final experiment. They destroyed the proteins, the carbohydrates, the lipids, and lo and behold, it was the nucleic acids that actually did the transforming. So they knew, you know, their result was the transforming principle, and hence the genetic material must be DNA. Published in a major scientific journal, major deal, but many people did not believe them because they had the protein bias. They said, you know, it's got to be proteins. You know, we don't believe your experiment. You must have a flaw in your experiment. So people didn't believe them. So finally, in 1952, there was another famous experiment done. So this is experiment three. So I just finished experiment two. This is experiment three. Alfred Hershey and Martha Chase finally established that DNA is the genetic material. And the way they did it was using a virus. And this virus has a special name. It's called a bacteriophage, or just phage. And this virus infects only bacteria. So, I mean, you guys probably think, oh, bacteria attacks us. You know, we can get sick by bacteria. Viruses can attack us. We can get sick by viruses. But you probably never realized that viruses can actually attack bacteria. So they can kill bacteria. And that's what a bacteriophage does. And it's that strange, crazy-looking creature that looks like an alien spacecraft up on the upper right. That's what it is. And the word derivation is phago means to eat. And so bacteriophage means bacteria eater. It doesn't really eat the bacteria. It just kind of kills it. So what was known at the time was this. They worked with a phage called T2, special kind of bacteriophage, and they knew, like most viruses, it was made of two chemicals, proteins and DNA. They knew that, okay? And so what they also knew that when T2, the phage, infects an E. coli bacteria, it could turn the bacteria into a T2-producing factory. And so if you see on my illustration here, you'll see the, take a look on the right, you'll see there's the E. coli bacteria, the phage infects it and lands on it and injects something into it. And then that something causes more viruses to be manufactured. And then the viruses are all put back together. There's a whole bunch of them inside of the bacteria. And then they cause the bacteria to explode. That's called lysing. And the explosion of the bacteria, you know, obviously kills the bacteria and releases all the viruses so they can go infect more bacteria. So what was not known at the time was what was that material that was being injected into the bacteria? Was it DNA or was it protein? So their very clever experiment was this. How do you determine which is which? And the experimental background is really cool. It's very, very clever what they did. First of all, they knew that proteins, they wanted to find an element that is only found in proteins and not found in DNA. And that element is sulfur. And they also knew that sulfur has a radioactive isotope, S35. And then they said, oh, let's find another element that's only found in DNA, but not in proteins, and that element is phosphorus. And they also found, they knew that there's a radioactive isotope of phosphorus called P32. And knowing that, They were all teed up to do an amazing experiment, and here's what they did. In the first experiment, and by the way, the picture on the right is from another book other than ours, and it's really an awesome book. The entire experiment is illustrated in sort of picture form, in almost cartoonish form, really nice summary of the experiment. But what they did is they grew the T2 phages in a medium containing radioactively labeled phosphorus. Okay? Now remember, phosphorus is only found in DNA. And then what they did is they allowed that bacteriophage to infect the bacteria, and then after a while, they put the whole mess in a blender so to detach the virus from the cell. And then they blended the material, or they took the blended material, and then they put it in a centrifuge so they could spin it down and separate the two parts. And it turns out that down in the bottom of the tube, that's where the bacterial material would go. It goes to the bottom and forms a pellet. And the virus is found up in the liquid part on top. And so that's the way you sort of separate the virus from the bacteria. And that upper part, which is liquid, is called the supernatant. Let's make sure we can say that, supernatant. Yeah. And lo and behold, they found that the pellet, the P32 isotope, was found in the pellet with the bacteria. Okay? That gave them a suspicion about what was the hereditary material. But they needed to do a second experiment to confirm this. And the second experiment was, they took the T2 phages, but this time they grew them in a medium containing only radioactively labeled sulfur. And so, remember, sulfur is only found in protein, and they allowed the labeled phages to infect the bacteria like they did before. Then once, after a while, they put the whole mess in a blender to detach the virus from the cell. And then they took the blended material, they centrifuged it, and then they looked at, remember, the bacterial material goes to the bottom. It's called the pellet. The virus is up on top in the supernatant. And lo and behold, when they tested where is the radioactively labeled material, they found that the S32 is found in the supernatant with the virus. And so they concluded from that, therefore, that DNA, because it was found with whenever the bacteria, that's where the DNA was, and the protein was found with the virus, that the DNA is what enters the bacterial cells and directs the assembly of the new virus particles. And hence, you know, they finally established the fact that, lo and behold, it is indeed the DNA that is the hereditary material. And so it took, like, from 1944 to 1952 in this experiment to finally establish for the first time, you know, to, I'd say, the satisfaction of the entire scientific community, that DNA was indeed the hereditary material. Now, that was the beginning of the story, because now, in the next year, who came along and did another revolutionary thing? Big time revolutionary thing. Anybody know? Who came along? Two people, actually, came along. Yeah. Watson and Crick. So you've got this incredibly ambitious American young guy in his early 20s, James Watson, who essentially wanted to be famous. He says, how can I be famous? He goes, if I could figure out the structure of the hereditary material, that'd be a pretty big deal. And so I would be very famous. And so essentially, that's what he did. He went after this with a vengeance. And he was really the catalyst, I would say, to make this happen. And he partnered with Francis Crick, who was a super smart guy at Cambridge. And together they cracked it. And they figured out that DNA is indeed a double helix. And tomorrow I'm going to show you about 30 minutes of a fantastic film on the discovery of DNA. And it's a reenactment. And Jeff Goldblum plays James Watson. And he does an amazing job. I mean, you watch the guy on screen, and you're like, that. I've seen Watson several times. I've met him, and he acts and looks exactly like James Watson. Of course, quite a bit younger, when he was in his 20s. But it's pretty amazing film. So I think you'll enjoy it. Okay, that's it.